Hello there, this is Jim, the Keys bartender, coming to you from a beautiful and temperate Key Largo in the Keys Bartender Podcast, the podcast about bartending and Keys life and life. So I want to start this episode about shelf life. You know, just because you're dealing with liquor doesn't mean that there's a unlimited time that you can serve your items. And one of the most important things that people really don't put in to effect is being able to rotate your stock. You all know that when you're using things like milk, dairy products, juices, even sodas, there's a shelf life. This, if you store soda too long, like bottle, if you use bottled or canned sodas, there's a shelf life for that where they go flat. Beer, liquor, and wine, they all have shelf lives where you can even wine, because you always hear these stories about wine that people purchase in auction for 100-year-old bottles of wine and things like that. It is not unlimited. I guess the longest one would be spirits because of the high alcohol content. So, on this episode, we're just going to discuss, and oh, we're not really not going to discuss because it's only one-way conversation right now, isn't it? So, let me start about talking about beer. Now, generally, we have beer. Kegs, you should obviously you should try to use a keg within a month if it's stored, because that's oxidation occurs as soon as you start opening any container that has beer, and that goes for kegs even, unless you're using a nitrogen system where you're using an inert gas in the beer to keep it from oxidizing. That's the thing that changes the flavor of the beer. And recently, or like the last 15 years, they started putting born-on dates on beer. And that's dates that beers were brewed on. And now they have expirations. And generally, beer, if it's unopened and stored in a draw, a cool, dry, unlit place, you have up to about 9 months at most with beer before it starts turning. Yeah, it's a lot less than you think a lot of these times. Now, when beer is refrigerated, you have 1 to 2 years. And if you run a bar, there's always that oddball brand of beer you have that's just sitting in there, that's been sitting in your cooler for about 3, 4 years. You got to use it, or you got to shit can it. That's what we call a shit can. Get rid of it. And one of the things is, ultraviolet light affects beer. That's why you find a lot of beers are in darker bottles. Clear bottles are more susceptible to being exposed to UV light, and that quickens the process, the aging process of the beer. You don't want it to be aged. It gets beer gets a kind of a cardboardy kind of taste to it sometimes, and I haven't really experienced that much with that, because I drink a 0.0 beers, and I imagine 0.0 beers having even shorter span of life. But generally, like I said, unrefrigerated up to 9 months. And also, when it comes to beer, it depends on the temperature you're storing it. If you're storing beer in a uncontrolled environment, meaning it's hot outside in summertime, you can have as little as 3 days before that beer starts turning. You don't want to store beer in a place where it's 90 degrees. You don't want to get too hot. Now, a lot of you said, now it really doesn't matter. Well, it does affect the taste. It does affect the taste of the beer. Just because a beer is turned doesn't mean it's unhealthy. Generally, because of pH level and the alcohol in beer, normally there's not the kind of the microbes don't become harmful because of that, because of the pH and the alcohol levels. And also, the higher the alcohol by volume or alcohol by weight, generally With a higher one, you have a potentially longer shelf life. Now, canned beer lasts longer than bottled beer because of the fastness of the top. And if you've had a beer, a lot of the experienced bartenders, you had a beer where you unopen one and you put the pop the cap back on. Generally, you started the oxidation process, and it's only going to be good if you keep it refrigerated, maybe 24 hours, 48 at most. So you have to really keep it in a cool, dark place, and so you have 4 to 6 months at most in a cool, dark place. Now, the higher the temperature, the less time you have. So it's very important with all items like that you have is generally, and I'm not gonna, that's the reason why I just skipped over juices and milk, because you really do that at home all the time. You've been doing it your whole life. But that's why the importance for you unexperienced, the importance of rotating stock. So when you get new beer in or new liquor or anything, you don't want a bottle sitting someplace in the back, whether beer, wine, or liquor, without pulling up the old stock. So you use it first, and the one you just get delivered, put in the back. So that's why you call stock rotation. You want to get into the habit of doing that. So beer typically can't develop a mold. It's the only reason it can develop a mold is if you have a problem in the process of brewing. So you just want to be able to do those things and take care of it. Let's get on to the liquor. Now, liquors, if they're unopened, especially the clear liquors like gin, vodka, and rum, they're virtually that you could keep store those for decades. Now you have to worry about the breakdown of plastic, the plastic lids, generally, because that could happen, because plastic does break down. But if you're already storing that, you should know that. I've been to some places where they had a bottle of Galliano sitting around for years. And I can tell you that Galliano bottle that you have from, because it's a liqueur, it's bad. It's bad already. So liqueurs have the shortest life out of all those. So Baileys, any of your the root beer schnapps, peach schnapps, brandies, and things like that. Once they're open, you got 6 months to a year. One of the things that people really find surprising is vermouth. Because, especially with dry vermouth, unless you make a ton of martinis, a lot of these vermouth bottles, especially dry vermouth, because you use in martinis, a dry vermouth, you use just the imperceptible amount. I made over a course of a year at the last place I worked, I may have used about 6 ounces of dry vermouth a year. And that's making hundreds of martinis because I put very little dry vermouth in. And that has to be one of those things that no one ever sends a martini back. It seems as if no one sends a martini back, but because there's not enough dry vermouth in there. Most orders that come in are just the imperceptible amount of vermouth in there. Sometimes you don't even put any in there because people really don't want to taste that. So you have a tendency to hold on to them. First of all, you have to, once you open up a bottle of vermouth, you have to use that vermouth within 6 to 8 weeks, even if it's refrigerated. And that's, people have a tendency to buy the larger bottle because they sell smaller bottles. I would suggest you buy smaller bottles of the vermouth, unless you go through a lot of it, a big place, and you go through a lot of it, because vermouth can turn slightly. I don't even know what you call it, if you call it rancid or sour or something like that, because vermouth is a wine, is a fortified wine. So that's the one thing that's known. And you have to keep it refrigerated once you open it. Because it's in a matter of a week that it starts turning. Yes, it does start turning. It's so bad, people, I guess vermouth is so bad that people don't even notice that it's gone bad. There was only one, I think, I've never had anybody in all the years I've bartended order a vermouth, a sweet vermouth on the rocks. And the only time I've seen that was in the movie Groundhog Day, when Andy McDowell is at a bar in the movie. It's a Groundhog Day was Bill Murray movie and stuff like that. And she goes in a bar and she orders sweet vermouth on the rocks. And that has to be one of the funkiest drinks. If you drink sweet vermouth, you have to almost ask, do you have a fresh bottle of sweet vermouth? Could you open it? Because I can tell you that's going to be a horrible experience. Because that vermouth probably has been open for at least a year. And every place I've seen it says 6 to 8 weeks. So there is a shelf life for vermouth. Now, liqueur is 6 to 1 month. And then once you open a spirit bottle, it's 1 to 3 years. It's 1 to 3 years. That's non-refrigerated. And if you're at an outside bar where it's exposed to sunlight, it's even less. It's even less. If something's oaked or like a whiskey that was barrel age has a tendency to have more stability over time. So you can probably sit on it for a while. You know, when I say sit on it. So you want to keep everything oxidizes, that's liquor, beer. Let's get on the wines. I know I'm kind of skipping over, but these are the short ones. Now, white wines have the shorter life. They're about 1 to 2 years past the expiration date on it. People have the tendency to think you can keep wine forever. Now, once you open wine, especially red wine, it starts oxidizing and it starts changing. Now, a lot of red wines, they need to, especially the finer vintages. I'm not talking the mass produced ones, the ones they sell in the big bottles. So the more tannins and the higher alcohol content wine, the longer life they have. Now, when you open up a bottle of red wine, it's generally good for that day, unless you keep it cool or you take the air out of it, because oxidation is going on and wines get affected very much by that. That's the reason why it kind of mellows out. Red wine needs to mellow out a little. That's why people open it up and they put it in a carafe that kind of opens up the wine and exposes it to oxygen, and it mellows out the sugar. Now, higher the sugar in the wine, the longer the life is with that. But as I said, with regular wines that you use in a bar, there's once you have it happy hour, when you just order a Cabernet, you don't ask for the name of it. It's not a wine list. White wine's 1 to 2 years, red wine's 2 to 3 years, and you still got to keep it cool and dry. And that doesn't mean open. Once that wine's open, a white wine, generally you got up to a week with a white wine. A red wine, you have a couple days. You have a couple days on that. Now, a fine wine, I'm going to put a blank one, about 10 to 20 years. But that's stored in a cool, dry place on its side. And it could be on a side, or you can do a deep tilt on it. And normally you tilt them. The highest ones for that are the sweeter wines, like port, which is 50 to 100 years, and sherry, which is 75 years. And most people don't have, a large. I worked at a place here in Key Largo that had about eight different ports, and ports are more stable because of their higher alcohol content. And actually, you don't really have to do much with them as long as you don't expose it to sunlight and you keep it in a temperature control room. You can open it and pour it over some time because of the higher alcohol content. Now, a Riesling for a white wine, Rieslings have one of the, a German Riesling is probably the longest one, about 15 to 25 years, or Chardonnay that has been oaked, real oaky Chardonnay, has a longer life, about 10 years. So those are the things you're going to be looking at. And that's why it's really important to think of your stock. Now, just because you got a bottle of Gallo wine, I don't even know if they make Gallo anymore. I think they may make Gallo. You don't generally want to keep a bottle of Gallo wine more than a year. It's not going to turn into something fine just before you store it. It's not like a coin from the Roman Empire that you put it, you put it in a time capsule, and 100 years later it's worth something. No, it's going to taste like shit. And that's where you hear about vinegar, wine turning to vinegar because of the age of it. So you're going to watch your temperature on most of your items. And that goes for liquors even. Once you open them up, you got to keep everything kind of cool. The heat will destroy it, and light will affect almost everything that you have. So the higher the heat, the shorter the life. And you got to think about rotating your stock. And that thus ends the lesson today for that. I'll be back in a moment. Well, hello. I am back again. We had a love. When I say we had our, I guess I did do a recording, didn't I? On Saturday, if that's correct. We, the wife and I went to an outdoor concert in Isle Mirada. We have a band show, and it was there were two local bands, but it was just a lovely night. We had that was very relaxing. I think did we grab a dinner that night? Did we go out? No, we went out yesterday, but the rest of the week, I had 3 days off, What a great time to relax. And you need that from every time. I mean, that's why I like to work maybe 6-7 days in a row. If they're going to give me 3 days off, I don't feel guilty about it. Then I'm missing out. And then I just take those 3 days. It's mental health adjustment days. But there was still a little work we had to do. You know, it's housework, obviously, and things, you know, responsibilities to have around the house. But we were doing many people across in any place. We were getting, we had our daughter, who's a junior in high school, her car was getting a little old. I had had a car my father and stepmother had. I picked it up 8 years ago, and she was driving it, and it was getting up there. It was about 13 years old, and it was time for her to get a car of more recent vintage, since we're talking about wine, but and lower mileage. Because we wanted to be more reliable as she ventured further and further from home. So we started our research about a month and a half, 2 months ago, looking at vehicles that she would want. And we toyed with the idea, if we were going to go with an older car, we were more likely to go with one that we buy directly from the owner. But that's always kind of a difficult process because it's few and far between. When you have someone, a personal owner selling a car, they're only going to show you one, generally, unless they have multiple cars they're selling, then they're pretty much a dealer, aren't they? A car dealer. So that's what we opted for this past Saturday. We went up to Miami, and one of the dealers we went up to, we were following, they had a car, and it was one of those ones that grab you in the advertisements. It was only 2 or 3 years older. The price was really good. It was low mileage, and it was a model that you would like. So I contacted the dealer, and I'm talking to the dealer through messaging. And I think I spoke to him on the phone also that we were going to be coming up there, and we asked if they still had the car. And they said, yes. So we're heading up about 50 miles north, 55. And on a Saturday, it, you know, it takes about an hour, 15 hour and 20 minutes because you got to, you're fighting traffic that's coming down. And, you know, there's people leaving the Keys at the same time. So we get up there and we wait in the showroom when we arrive there. And I'm informed, it's, oh, that's the person, in, the person you spoke to is in charge of our internet sales. Let's contact him. So, and could you tell us the car you were looking at? And I said, well, you know, the car, it's the car you were advertising there. And supposedly they still have it available. And they told me, this person told me that it was still available. The person said, no, it's not available. And I had informed the person that I had some experience with selling cars. I sold cars for a dealership for about a year or two. And they just said no. And I guess because of the car we were looking for, they just said, do you have any other car similar to that? And they didn't even attempt to, she said, we have no car in that price range or like that now. And I said, really? You're not even going to attempt to show us another vehicle? And they said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, okay. So I thanked them and I said, very, very unusual that, they, you know, you wouldn't take a bite at the apple. I'm the apple and you're not going to try to sell me anything. I said, well, I guess they're selling plenty of cars. So we went just, there were dealerships all over the place on this section of, it's called Dixie Highway. It's near Route 1 in Miami. And there's dealerships up and down this stretch of road. So we go less than a quarter mile up the road and we end up talking to a particular salesman and he shows us three vehicles. And they're a couple grand more. One is about $8,000 more. But you know what? The vehicles we're looking for. We're looking for a reliable vehicle, relatively recent. And we ended up, you know, the process of buying a car, there's some give and take. And you know, you tell them what your baseline and you can get the price that you work with the price with the salesman. And then you got to go into the finance department and in the finance department, unless you're buying it straight out, which I think is sometimes a really good idea just to have the loan ready and to say, well, listen, we figured out that there's probably going to be they try to get you with destination charges, things like that. And they, and it's usually like $1,800 on whatever. So you try to, you know, negotiate a lower price. You make sure they're not trying to add too much onto it. And you say, well, this is the baseline. I want to pay for it because it, this is the price advertised. I know we have to pay taxes and registration, things like that. Yes. But other than that, we really don't need this certification program that you put on that, you know, they try to hit you with a $2,500 charge on top of it. And I'm like, yeah, come on. That is the, I don't want to call it fallacious, but it's fictitious. Really is. I said, what does it do? What do you get with that? And then they tell you, well, it's the way we check things out and stuff. Well, that should be factored into price. It should be factored in price. So I'm going to, I stick with this price. And I said, I want the total price to be this. I want the total price to be this, not 5,000 more than we originally discussed. And so we ended up doing that and they made a deal. So if you want to make a deal with us today, we'll leave here with it. We ended up leaving with that. So we had the old vehicle. Now that is somewhat problematic when you do it down here, just like you would any place else. You have to sell it, and there's multiple ways of selling the vehicle nowadays. You put the little, you know, you just put the placard on it, put on the price, you put your phone number, and you could do it that way, just putting it out there. But I choose to use social media. I'm a big believer in it. But the problem when you put it on social media, you get people that are looking to scam you, and there's multiple ways of them doing it. They can purchase the vehicle, send a carrier to come and pick it up and do a scam where a payment scam where you actually, they're sending you supposed money, but the check isn't really, whatever it is. If they're coming to, if someone's looking to purchase a vehicle without looking at it, question that. Because anybody that would purchase a vehicle without looking at it is taking a chance that they're buying a piece of shit. So you got to question their intentions. So I had the car. It had like 138,000 miles on it, a lot. And we realized you can't trade that in. There's no dealership in the world that really has the wherewithal to sell that on their lot, because a dealership has to have a couple of grand, at least $3,000, maybe $4,000 room to be able to negotiate and insure and check it up and detail it and get everything ready for it. So it's at least $4,000. It could be $5,000 nowadays. But in my day, it was $2,500 to $3,000 when I sold the vehicle. So I imagine it would be about $5,000 more now. So you can say, well, we don't have that much room. They have plenty of room in used cars because you buy low and you sell high. In new cars, you have just once, you know, from the list price, unless they do add-ons, you have generally it's the percentage of profit in a new car is a lot less, but there's a lot less to haggle with a new car, because you can pretty much find out what the base price is. You can't find that out for your used car. So here I go. I list out the price. I talk to my mechanic and people around, and they generally think the car's worth $3,500. That my daughter's car, even though there's no problems with it. There's no problems with it at the time. It's running well. There's no reason why it shouldn't run for another year or two. So I put on a number of $4,500. And that's, used cars are high now. So I put it on $4,500 because I realized that most people aren't going to buy it for the price that you put on it. So I put $4,500. It's a 13-year-old vehicle. It's 130. There's no damage to it. It's never been in an accident, a reportable accident. Because we did get bumped from behind, but it really didn't even leave a dent. We didn't have to get it fixed. There was no mark left on it, but because it was a 5 to 10 mile per hour bumper, right? And so I get several calls. I had listed it on a Saturday, and one call, someone wanted to come on Sunday from Deer Key, and another person was from the neighborhood. So I said, show the person in the neighborhood. The people in the neighborhood came in and they looked at it for like an hour and 15 minutes, hour and 30 minutes. Cause we went on a ride. We went for a 15 minute ride, pretty long demo. But I figured, since I'm asking someone to buy a 13-year-old vehicle, 130,000 miles on it, I better give them that kind of ride. And I think that and I told them everything. I was forthright of everything on the vehicle. I told them what was done, what kind of work was done. I said we had a timing chain issue one time, but we got that fixed. There's no ongoing problem. The gentleman that was buying, his father was a mechanic, and he was on the phone with him at least 20 minutes. And I'm sitting with the gentleman's wife. And I said, yeah, the brakes are good. The tires are great. The AC blows cold. The engine runs fine. I don't think you're going to have a problem. I really necessarily wouldn't take it on a long journey, but it's great for running around the Keys with. And we came back and they ended up taking it for close to what I was asking price. But I was so shocked at the person that was coming up about 70 miles from near Key West, which is, you know, we're at mile marker 102. These people were at mile marker 25. And they were going to come up. And I'm thinking, wow. Because, yeah, if they're going to buy from the owner, they have the whole Keys to pick from. That's it. There's only 90,000 people. It's not like Miami. You go up to Miami, you have, half a million people. Down here, at most, we have about 80,000 people down here. And it's all spread out. And these people, the guy already said, would you take 4,000? But the person that I saw eventually, I sold vehicles several times using the internet, and I usually had to come off close to one vehicle came off $1,000. Another one, it came off like almost about the same, another $1,000. They were high mileage vehicles. And this one, it was generally, it was only $200 it came off. So I was thinking in my head, I said, oh man, my initial offering was low. But I was relatively shocked that I listed it and sold it the next day. And everyone was pretty surprised. They said, you must have showed it, you know, asked for a low price. And my mechanic had initially told me to list it at around $3,500. I could get $3,500 for it. I ended up getting $4,300 for it. I guess he knew the value of it. But he doesn't really know the value of what used cars are going for right now. And I just expected a week or 2 weeks of talking to people, driving around, having people take a look at it. But it was so, so shocking that as soon as I started listening, people saying $3,500 without even looking at it. And I said, I sent a text back then. I said, listen, I just listed this yesterday. Why would you make an offer lower sight unseen? Why would I accept it right after I know? Because I didn't even get a chance to show it to anybody yet. And people are saying, what is your lowest price that you accept? And I said, how much are you willing to pay for a vehicle you never sold? I mean, you never saw before. What if I said 4,000? Would you take it? If I say 2,000, what if it doesn't? What if it's leaking oil, the brakes are spongy, the tires are running bald, right? There's the upholstery's falling apart, and I tell you 3,000, and you don't even know. You haven't even taken a look at it, and you show up. I mean, why would you give that away and say what's your negotiating point? It's tantamount to saying, if you're going on a date, you're a girl going on a date, say, listen, the guy says, if I take you out to dinner, what kind of restaurant do I need to take you out so we can spend the night together? And someone says Olive Garden. And then you show up at the door and you look at the girl and you say, listen, I think we might, and you take an assessment of it, I think maybe we should go to McDonald's. Because you've lowered your negotiating point. You should never lower your negotiating point. You should stick to it and say, no, this is my hard and fast rule. And then it's your decision. If you come off your negotiating point in the beginning without having the opportunity to display your wares, where could you possibly go after that? It's just a life lesson. And that's a nice thing. I mean, I always think you should always give a little back when when you post something, you say, oh, I'm firm. I always put whatever I'm listing, some else or best offer, because there is, if something doesn't sell, you're generally probably going to say, well, I'm selling it, so obviously you don't want it anymore. So there is a value. I would go a little lower depending upon demand. And you always got to think about demand for that. Well, that's all I had to say today about it. That's a life lesson. It's not life generally. I know it's not normally what I talk about, but it was interesting. I felt a great sense of accomplishment at the end of the day. So I'll talk to you later. This is Jim the Keys Bartender. Until next time.